second case this morning is case number 54412, Consolidated Nevada Corp. versus JH Inc. Mr. Vacco and Breslow for the appellants, Mr. Desmond for the respondent.
Good morning.
Good morning.
If it may please the court, my name is Dennis C. Vacco. I am with the law firm of Olympus Mathias Wechsler and Friedman. I am here today with my co-counsel in this matter, Barry Breslow, who is of the Reno law firm of Robertson, Belstege, Sharp and Lowe. Together we represent the appellants, Consolidated Nevada Corporation. I might refer to them in the course of the argument as CNC, and Paul A. Morabito. I would like, Your Honor, to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal at the end of my my argument.
Certainly.
This appeal is grounded in a very complex commercial transaction between the parties that was ultimately closed on July 2nd of 2007. Stealing a phrase from the case just before us, this appeal is really the first round in a multi-round fight between these two very contentious litigants.
Mr. Vacco, just on that point, it's come to our attention that the additional rounds are starting to wind their way up to the Supreme Court, you know, like that. Can we resolve this case by itself, or is it something we have to kind of bring everything together, maybe in a consolidating them and do it all at once? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, Your Honor, it's interesting because we have just, I believe, we filed yesterday with the Supreme Court a stipulation entered into by both parties agreeing to a consolidation of the three appeals that have not yet been briefed. Because this appeal was so far along in its process, the argument was scheduled, the case was fully submitted. We did not include this appeal, but To your question, Justice Gibbons, I really think that the determination in this case, in this particular appeal, really represents the linchpin, in my estimation, of the entire case and all of the issues that follow, and all of the issues that will be brought before this court on appeal, in my estimation, are either permeated by the determination in this case, or quite frankly, in my estimation, this is truly the linchpin of everything else that proceeded after Justice Adams accepted the determination of the independent accountant. And perhaps if I could just...
Is the determination of the independent accountant in effect the keystone of the judgment that's under appeal in the case that was most recently appealed?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that it is for this reason. The determination of the independent accountant, and by the way, we're not here today asking this court to conduct a review of the particulars of the independent accountant's findings. What this appeal is grounded in is our concern over the process. We believe that the process itself, which led to the determination, was fatally flawed, and that District Court Judge Adams, erred when he just simply, without findings, without addressing the issues that we raised in a motion to disqualify and in opposition to the motion to confirm, he didn't address those issues and just adopted the determination. And because if the determination was arrived at through a fatally flawed process, then in my estimation, everything that flowed thereafter was, in the ultimate bench trial, influenced by this determination, and here's why. And I won't bore you with all of the complexities of the contract, but simply put, on the date of closing, the parties had agreed, pursuant to the terms of the contract, that the seller would provide an estimate of the working capital as of the date of closing. And the agreement, the contract indicated that the money would flow in either direction. If the working capital was positive, the sellers would pay that additional amount, or if it was negative, they would get a credit on the purchase price. But the contract itself laid out in Section 2.5 a very explicit mechanism to true up, if you will, that initial working capital determination through a process in overtime. And while there will be disagreement amongst the parties as to, you know, whether each party fulfilled their obligations in terms of meeting the time deadline, at the end of the process, if the parties could not agree to a working capital calculation retrospectively after the deal closed, then the contract called for the appointment of an independent accountant to come in and not be an advocate for one side or the other, but for an independent accountant to come in and simply do an investigation, conduct an analysis as to what the working capital was on July 2nd, 2007, the date of closing. In this case, the evidence is quite clear that the seller showed up at the date of closing and said that the working capital was a positive $3.1 million, which was added to the purchase price. Thereafter, the sellers, in their calculation and analysis, determined through their calculation that the number was upside down some $11 million. So, you know, a differential between a positive 3.1, which they paid, and their calculation of an 11. There was, pursuant to the contract, a give and take, back and forth. We'll disagree over how extensive or how meaningful that exchange was by both parties. But what we can't disagree on is that the contract said if they couldn't agree after a period of time, we'll appoint an independent accountant. Unfortunately, they couldn't even agree on an independent accountant.
We understand those facts. The issue that I think would be most germane is whether under assuming Chapter 38 applies, whether there's been a waiver or a waiver, let's call it that, with respect to the ability of your client to show prejudice associated with Scott's contact with DWC.
Well,
you first follow of all, the question? That's what I'm interested in.
No, I understand it. And I do think that NRS 38, the Arbitration Act, does apply, primarily because the district court judge, in his order appointing the independent accountant, did so pursuant to the act. He did it also in consistent with the terms of the contract, but he cited the act in making the appointment. So what we believe that all we have to show is that there was evident partiality or misconduct, misbehaving on the part of the arbitrator pursuant to the terms of the act. And we believe that the record is quite extensive in terms of the misbehaving, if you will, or the evident partiality of the independent accountant. We did not waive it. I mean, that's their claim. That's their claim. I believe that the record is more than sufficient to refute any waiver. They point to, well, let me just take a step back. I talked about the fact that under the contract, they could not agree to an independent accountant. They finally had to go to the court. We made the motion for the appointment of the independent accountant. The order that resulted, the order was negotiated by the two parties. I mean, if you look at the order, the order is signed not only by the district court judge, but by the parties. This was an order that the parties had carefully and very carefully and in great detail negotiated. So it's silly. It's almost ludicrous to now make the point that after all of this, after we make the motion for the appointment of the IA, after negotiating the contract, that then in one simple email in January of 2008, that or 2009, I forgot the exact date, but in that That's one okay. simple email, that we waived all of those rights, that we abrogated the terms of the order that we so carefully negotiated, it's a ludicrous proposition. But I want to draw the court's attention to the issue of prejudice, because I do believe that the evident partiality of the arbitrator is found in the arbitrator's own words. In their final, in their reports to the court, I think it's important to point out to the court. Here's what they say, and I'm quoting. This is in the joint appendix at 102385. I'm quoting, and this is from their determination, what they submitted to the district court. Quoting, the task for the independent accountants was to undertake a determination of the deficit's reported working capital as of July 2nd, 2007. Accordingly, all of the independent accountants' test work was performed on-site at BHI because the defendants became the custodian of the company's records, and it was the defendant's representation as to working capital that the independent accountants primarily were tasked to review. Nothing could be further from the truth. The contract didn't say that when the independent accountant is appointed that he's only going to review the buyer's calculation. It didn't say that he was only going to review the seller's calculation either. The independent accountant was always intended not to be an auditor of one party's results or the other. The independent accountant was always under the agreement, under the district court order, and under Nevada law, was intended to be to conduct their own investigation, not to simply audit one party or the other's results. They were to parachute in and take a snapshot, a look back in time to July 2nd of 2007 and make their own analysis of what the working capital was on that date. So the fact that in their report, in page 2 of their report, they in my estimation, Your Honor, they clearly evinced their evident partiality when they say that their mission was, and again quoting, the task of the independent accountants was to undertake a determination of the defendant's reported working capital as of July 2nd, 2007.
So you take that as a stated misconception of the job that independent auditor was to do?
I believe that because of the extensive and inappropriate contact with David Wood, who was the seller's CFO after the closing, it's important to also point out that Mr. Wood was the person who developed the seller's original working capital calculation under the terms of the agreement. So the guy that they had the most contact with, and in the defendant's brief, they'll claim that we consented to Wood's appointment as the person most knowledgeable. Again, that's not accurate. There's an email in the record from an associate of our predecessor law firm indicating that Wood was not the person most knowledgeable. But we believe that over time, their mission morphed because of the inappropriate contact with Mr. Wood. I'd like to preserve the last 2.42 minutes.
Before you sit down, are you asking for us to vacate and remand for an evidentiary hearing with respect to this partiality or misconduct, or are you asking for reversal and vacator of the IAC's findings?
Your Honor, I'm from New York, so I
want the whole deal.
I like to swing for the fence. So what I am asking for is for this court to use its de novo powers to reverse this determination, and to appoint, for this court to appoint, a new, truly independent accountant to come in and make this working capital calculation, or in the alternative, to remand to the district court with instructions to vacate the determination and then to conduct a hearing on our claims about the evident partiality of DWC.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Desmond?
Good morning. Thank you, Justice Cherry, and may it please the court. I want to pick up to Justice Gibbons' comment at the outset as to, is this a discrete issue within a complex dispute, or is this the linchpin of the remainder of the case? There's no question that this is one small piece of an otherwise complex dispute. The reason Judge Adams carved this out to have this decided separately was because it's a true-up provision, as are in a lot of business deals, where there's a working capital true-up that's to take place within a couple months after the close of the deal. That's what we're talking about here. The independent accountants were tasked with doing just that. As to counsel's point that they went beyond the scope of their duties, the language, undertake a determination of the closing date financial report, that's from the contract. Section 2.5D of the contract says the task of the independent accountants is to undertake a determination of the closing date financial report. That quote from the determination that he just said evidence or shows evident partiality, the contract itself. It's also in the very order appointing the independent accountants. It says their sole task is to undertake a determination of the capitalized term closing date financial report. If you go to the contract itself, it defines the closing date financial report as the report provided by my clients after closing. But that was clearly contemplated under the contract. There's no question about that. So how following the terms of the contract can constitute evident partiality simply makes no sense. To put the context of this dispute into focus, though, I want to focus on a couple of different provisions of the contract and of that order appointing the independent accountants, which we agree is a very important order. The appointment order was carefully vetted and drafted by the parties. Indeed, if you look at the order, it's prepared on appellant's counsel's letterhead. If you go to paragraph 5 of that order, it describes the scope of the investigation and powers that the independent accountants are to have. It says, and I quote, the independent accountants are authorized as officers of the court to obtain any documents, invoices, or records from third-party vendors, interview any representative or employee of the parties or third parties in order to complete their review and determination of disputed items. This is exactly what the independent accountants did in their determination. They went to BHI and reviewed the records of the company. The very conduct of which the appellants now complain is the conduct that the independent accountants were tasked to do under the contract. If you go to section 2.5D of the contract and paragraph 10 of the order, it says that the determination of the independent accountants is to be final and binding. Again, that's from the language of the contract. This is not a determination which we should even be talking about. Pursuant to the contract, it was to be final and binding, not subject to review. Contrary to the position that the appellants are now taking, the independent accountants were never tasked with undertaking an independent determination of the calculation of working capital. If you look at the letter that appellants sent to the independent accountants back in from December 18th of 2008, when they had been repeatedly asked for records and said, we don't possess any records related to working capital. All the records are at BHI. If you want to inspect the records, you have to go to BHI. If you look at that December 18th letter, they state, again, contrary to what you just heard from counsel, your sole task, independent accountants, is to undertake a determination of the closing date financial report. That's exactly what they did. I want to go through some of actually what happened here to sort of put the issues raised by appellants into context. When the independent accountants undertook their assignment, my client provided records and reports supporting its closing date financial report. The independent accountants, pursuant to the order, asked appellants for the same thing. Please provide us your records that support your estimate of working capital. They didn't get anything in response. They asked again and again. Finally, they said, if you don't provide the information, we're going to have to seek the assistance of the court in getting it. That's when appellants finally said, we don't possess any records. We don't have any records that support our estimate of working capital. Any records that exist are located at BHI. We have no records in our possession. At the same time they concede they have no records, they sent the independent accountants another letter reiterating that their sole task was to focus on the closing date financial report, which was the report prepared by my clients, pursuant to the express terms of the contract. They agreed with that. In fact, they directed them. They said, you shouldn't be looking to us for any records. We don't have any. If you look at the standards for evident partiality or bias, the Health Plan of Nevada case on the issue of whether the independent accountants went beyond the scope of their duties, the court in that case commented on it, where they said arbitrators do not exceed their power if their interpretation of an agreement, even if erroneous, is rationally grounded in the agreement. There's no question when you look at the language of the agreement here that the independent accountants performed the task that they were absolutely required to do under the contract and by the order appointing them. One, I want to sort of follow through what happened after the independent accountants begin their task work. The independent accountants specifically informed the parties that they would perform their review and test work at Barry Hinckley, where both parties said any records would be located at Barry Hinckley. Appellant, we don't have any records. If you want records, you have to go to Barry Hinckley. They would be there. The independent accountants send the email that's referenced saying, we're going to conduct our review and task work on site at Barry Hinckley, which we think we can do without the parties present, with the exception of David Wood, who was the new CFO who came on at the time, who everyone agreed was the person most knowledgeable with respect to where records would be kept.
There a point that he went much further than directing them to places where records could be found and advocated his employer's position?
I don't think so, Justice Pickering. If you look at those 400 pages of records that were submitted, they were simply transitory memos saying, here's records related to this account. Here's records related to this account. I think the best evidence that he wasn't influencing them in any way, the one issue they identified that they claim bias was decided against my clients. So somehow the notion that he was influencing the outcome is absolutely belied by the records. Moreover, I think under paragraph 5, where the independent accountants were authorized to contact parties or locate records, they were absolutely empowered to do that task. I think, though, that the timing of when appellants raise their objections is really dispositive of this appeal. The independent accountants, after they began their review and test work, they had repeat visits. They came back for records. They informed the parties of that. Appellants concede that. They concede that of the 8 or 9 visits that the independent accountants made to review records, they were only not informed of one visit. We received emails informing them. There were invoices showing that they were coming back. It wasn't until April 20th, 2009, when the bulk of the difference in the working capital calculation related to accounts payable. The seller's estimate of accounts payable at the time of closing was approximately $3 million. When my clients came in and did their own calculation of working capital, they calculated it to be $11 million, a delta of over $8 million. In April of 2009, the independent accountants sent counsel for the parties an email informing them, we've completed our test work related to the accounts payable and have verified nearly 98% of the accounts payable of the buyer's calculation is accurate. It was only then, after they knew that the adverse determination had been made by the independent accountants, that they began to try to derail the process. The first allegation of improper contacts came in a letter May 12th, when it was obvious that a determination was imminent. What did the independent accountants do? They hired counsel. They said, if you have records you would like us to review, please provide them. If you have witnesses you would like us to talk to, please provide them. And the independent accountants did that. With respect to the accounts payable, the appellant said, we want you to go out and get third-party verifications from each vendor as to the amount of the accounts payable. And they did just that. It lengthened the process by 2 months, but they did exactly that. And to your point, Justice Pickering, each one of those accounts payable third-party verifications is an exhibit to the determination. So even if you accept their proposition that Mr. Wood was somehow going beyond transmitting information, it could not possibly have affected the result, because the determination is supported by third-party invoices. I mean, this isn't a situation where if Mr. Wood was whispering in their ear, it could influence the outcome. Their determination is supported by over 400 pages of verifications. The timing of their objections really speaks volumes about what they were trying to do. This was another effort to derail the process. Contrary to the suggestion that they move for the appointment of independent accountants, the record is clear that they refused initially to have independent accountants appointed. My clients had to move to compel the appointment of independent accountants. And they said, it's premature. It's not right. Conditions haven't been met. They're simply trying to delay the process. And once they knew that a determination was forthcoming, they tried to derail it once again. There's no question about that.
So your position is there's not even sufficient showing in this record to generate an issue of fact meriting a hearing on either misconduct or evident partiality?
I don't think there is, Your Honor, because they cannot point to a single error in the determination. I mean, you heard...
So there's no prejudice, even if there was.
They say they're attacking the process, but they can't point to a single error in the determination. They provided no records. There are no alternative calculations. And the record that was submitted to the district court, contrary to the situation in Graber, which they cited in their briefs, where there was some evidence that the district court hadn't considered arbitration transcripts or exhibits, the determination of the independent accountants is 15 and a half pages long and contains hundreds of pages of exhibits which support every line item in their determination. I don't think there's any question you can say that isn't supported completely. And with respect to the actual communications, they grossly misrepresent the nature of them. Frankly, I took offense at the suggestions that counsel was having ex parte contacts with the independent accountants when there's no citation in the record for that. I think a good example of that is they say even Tim Herbst, a party, was having communications with the independent accountants. Their citation to that is a single email in which Tim Herbst was copied asking him to sign an authorization so the independent accountants could send out a bank confirmation to third-party vendors as appellants requested with respect to accounts payable. And they're classifying that as ex parte contact. I submit to you that there's been some reckless representations as to the nature of the contacts, and a review of the record belies them.
Could you comment, though, on the extent of David Wood's contacts and make your best case for saying he entirely legitimately simply furnished information, that there's no issue of fact that he went beyond that?
I think there's no issue of fact because if you look at the so-called 8 or 9 memoranda that they claim, they're transmittal memos. He's saying, here's the information I'm including. This wasn't meant to be a game of 52-card pickup. I mean, the records have to have some context. So he was providing that context.
What about the billing entries, though, where they record conferences with him and so forth?
But if you look at the description in the billing entries, if you look at the actual affidavit of the person who performed the test work, he describes the nature of the contacts and said, in those billing entries, I was simply describing when I sat down with him and said, these are the records we need. We're still missing these items. And then it got described in a billing entry. But I don't think those billing entries are in any way are suggestive of any inappropriate contact.
Mr. Desmond, I was going to follow up on that because I think we're getting to the crux of this here. Is there any, and I'm going to ask Mr. Ivaca the same thing, is there any evidence in the record that Mr. Wood was lobbying Mr. Wilson or in any way to persuasively adopt this formula?
None, Your Honor, none. Mr. Wood was providing him with records. He was the only person who knew where records were. There's no evidence that he was lobbying him. The evidence they point to, the issues were actually decided against my clients. There's a $48,000 line item that they question where they say there's evidence that Mr. Wood was advocating on it. As we point out in our brief, that issue was decided against my clients. So if there's issue of bias on that, we did a pretty poor job of trying to convince him of it. I simply, when you look at the standards against which this is to be measured, this is not the traditional bias case where you have, one panel member reaching out to the lawyer, or you have the undisclosed conflict, as in the North Las Vegas case, or two arbitrators on a panel conferring with each other. This is a far cry from that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Benson.
I'm going to round off your rebuttal to 3 minutes, if you around about 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think you had to answer Justice Gibbons,
let me go right to your point. And while Mr. Desmond was there, so he knows this record far more intimately than I do, I really have to take exception to his characterization that Mr. Wood was, you know, merely a custodian, and he was only telling the independent accountant where the light switch was or where the files could be found. And I'm going to point to 15 JA 3610, which is an email dated 2009, interestingly, from David Wood at dwood@terribleherbst.com, which is the logo of the seller who's now running these stores, to Tom Herbrank, who's at DWC. There's nobody from the other side noticed on this email. There's nobody from the buyer or from the seller's team noticed on this email. A direct violation of the order, of the court's directive, there should be no ex parte communication.
What was the gist of the email?
Well, Your Honor, quite frankly, this email is quite significant because while Mr. Desmond didn't get to the issues that he raises on his cross appeal, one of them on his cross appeal was the issue of the inclusion of cash, whether or not cash. So here's what Mr. Wood, being an advocate, not a custodian, says on May 7th of 2009. In addition to the above, and as a result of reviewing the working capital calculation provisions in the agreement, and specifically the definition in section schedule 1.14A's, it appears that cash is not considered a working capital item. I wanted to bring this to your attention for consideration relative to the adherence to the amended restated stock purchase agreement. That is far more than being a custodian of the records. That's far more than telling them where the men's room is. This is being an advocate without us even being copied on this email of a position that they now ask this court to consider in their cross appeal. They were concerned about the inclusion of cash, and this email, more than anything, puts a bullseye on Mr. Wood's back in terms of his ex parte communications and the prejudicial impact of those ex parte communications. But they don't stand alone.
What do you do with his comment that on the issues where you've demonstrated arguable ex parte communications, the independent auditor went against his client, so there's no prejudice?
I don't believe that under the Act that we have to show prejudice. I believe that all we have to show under the Act is that the arbitrator misbehaved. And quite frankly, the consequence of this misbehavior, as I said when I first stood at this podium, is not just this first round of this $6.8 million, but it's the flawed process led to a $140 million judgment against my client. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel for their interesting argument in this case and briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted, and we'll be in recess till 11:30.